Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So today, the big news was Joe Biden's going to cancel the Keystone XL pipeline permit, which got all of the righties crazy at me. See, he hates workers. I'm going, no. It's not what he's saying. He's saying let's take their talents away from building pipelines and move them to building things that are going to move us towards a greener, healthier economy, and not just a pipeline that we're going to get one shot out of, and then for the next 50 years be stuck on the dirty stuff. But boy, were they crazy angry. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on, the big inauguration on Wednesday. Looking very much forward to hearing what Joe Biden has to say. I've asked our good friend Greg Hurwitz to come talk with us. Greg is a New York Times best-selling author. Make sure you check out his website, greghurwitz.net. Greg, thanks for taking time for us.
How you doing? Good to be back.
It's good to see you again. What do you think? Let's start with the Keystone XL pipeline. Do you think day one he rescinds the permit?
I don't know what he's going to do on day one. I think every argument that he makes on any matters that are environmental should be about job growth and creation and innovation. I think that's the whole deal. There's an unbelievable opportunity to be seized in terms of job creation and infrastructure. And if we lean into that, we're going to be good. If we don't, we're going to be in trouble.
No, that's been my whole take on all of this. If we're gonna get those on the Trump train to come around to some bit of sanity, not the conductors and not the people doing the work, but the people who are riding along, if we can get some of them into the sane world by making people's lives better, by making these investments in infrastructure and the jobs that come along with it, I think that goes a long way.
Well, and that's right. You know, for a long time, I think that the messaging of the left, not the work of, I don't want to say the left, the messaging of Democrats and liberals has been hijacked. We've been very focused on sort of language and permission structures rather than intentions and outcomes. And if we can get back to actually stating in concrete terms what we can do for American people and why that's something that can be accomplished, you know, that's the whole agenda. The quicker we can get out of ideological back and forth and the closer we can get to, you know, rolling out a vaccination that's effective, creating more jobs and making more money for workers who deserve to make more money, the better shape we're going to be in. That's the argument.
Absolutely.
There's a window right now, I feel like, a lot of the suburban women who sort of, you know, deserted Trump, who voted for Trump and then left and are over. If we can make good and claim the working class at this point, I mean, you're a union guy, you know this better than anyone. If we can see that through properly in the messaging, in the policies, in the platform, I think we're in great shape. If we want to get pulled into the culture wars, I think we're dead.
I absolutely agree with you. And that's why, you know, I keep looking at Wednesday going, I know there's going to be some calls for unity. There's going to be some olive branches and all of that. But ultimately, it's going to come down into the nuts and bolts and the policies that he pursues, which for me, it's all about jobs, jobs, jobs.
That's right. And when I talk about the culture wars, by the way, I'm not claiming that we leave or take for granted the communities that are suffering, that keep delivering wins to Democratic leadership or have. It's not about that, but it's about actually tackling the root causes of things. And so when we're dealing, you know, we have to look at the communities that are suffering. Who do we have? We have white working class, we have the African-American communities, we have brown communities. And if we can have a targeted approach at, say, the prison industrial complex, if we can get things done instead of talking about things, we're going to be in better shape for those communities. I think it's essential.
No, I'm right there with you. So, you know, let's take a step back real quick because I want to get some of your thoughts on what happened on January 6th. You know, I think a lot of people were shocked that, oh, my God, I can't believe this happened. Personally, I expected it. I expected, honestly, much worse because of just having read, you know, now that Parler's back, I get to get the inside track on the crazy that's there. But because I read what they were saying, I read the intentions that they went to Washington, D.C. thinking. I read them saying, hey, if someone tries to take my gun, I'm stacking up bodies. You know, I was expecting it. How is it that we completely missed this? And I'm curious what your thoughts of what happened.
Well, I think anyone who paid attention to history or the present moment was not surprised. But I think a lot of us are not paying attention to history or the present moment, right? We're siloed in our different information bubbles that's been talked about exhaustively. This is a very logical outcome of what we have seen happening. And people weren't prepared to look it in the face. And what's weird is, you know, there was a weird sense I had of violation that felt different. You know, those images, the Confederate flag marched through the hallways of the Capitol. You know, it didn't get within 5 miles during the Civil War. People wearing, you know, 6 million Jews wasn't enough. And I was glad it happened. I was delighted it happened. I thought the solution for anything is to pull it out under the full sterilizing light of day. And I think we all need to see that. We needed to see how extreme it was, and we needed to look it in the face. And there's a lot of people, you know, John Dean talks a lot about how this sort of, how you have to break frame, how you're moved within a sort of bubble further and further off the mark of a particular morality. And I feel like this is a frame break that a lot of people were still in denial of, including Ben Sasse, you know, who's back on the floor talking about shoveling your neighbor's driveway. People didn't seem to realize there was a murderous takeover of the Capitol building. And so as far as I see it, there's two messaging and strategic and moral imperatives. And all three of those to me are aligned. They're not different. That the Democratic Party and any reasonable thinking liberal should have. One of them is to offer an off-ramp for the enormous percentage of Republicans who that movement is not, who don't see themselves in that movement, who aren't down with the Confederate flag, who aren't down with people beating, literally beating police officers to death with fire extinguishers and beating them with the Blue Lives Matter flags. And to offer an off-ramp at this point to say, look, there's a lot churning in the underground, and here's the off ramp where you can get off and understand that we have to pull back from the brink of this. But I think there also has to be a serious level of accountability for what just happened and occurred at the Capitol. I think that it was a coup, and I think it was sedition. And I think that we have to have no holds barred going after the people who instigated and carried out that act. It was horrific.
No,
you know, at this point,
I'm right there with you. And I'm of the mindset that you can't begin talking about unity until you have that kind of accountability. And because I don't think you can do both simultaneously. I think you have to go and all those people who were part of this, they have to be brought out in the light of day.
I think the vast majority of Americans were horrified by that. You know, we have 75 million Americans who voted for Trump, 74 and change. I don't know the exact percentage of people who supported the Capitol attack. We have 80 million who didn't vote, right? And we know where the 80 million, was it 80 million who voted for Biden or some such, 80 something?
A little bit over.
But I think that most people, as more stories get out of what occurred and how that was, and people with zip ties and planning to take hostages, and people who had roadmaps, not just to particular Senate offices, but to their hideaways. And, you know, Rick, I mean, you've probably been to the Capitol building. That place is impossible to navigate. I mean, you know, I can't get through there. People knew right where they were headed. There was a lot going on there. And I think we were enormously close. I mean, a strike team of capable Russians armed with Kalashnikovs could have gone in and wiped out our whole government. 20 people with a clear mission plan. It was horrifying what happened. And I feel like there's a shattering of denial that is still occurring about how bad this got and how close we came. And I think we're gonna see the repercussions of that and the undeceiving of that continue to unfold over the next months.
Yeah, I mean, it's, and to highlight your point, I don't think most people understand exactly the magnitude because I don't think that we've seen enough of the video yet. I don't think we've seen enough of the stories of the people who were there and their intentions. And that will come with the trials, and that will come with, you know, clearly in the investigations that are coming. But you're right. You know, we were very close to having our whole government wiped out. And you brought up Ben Sasse's name. I can't help but think of, had they found those senators, would Ben Sasse have been in the line of those who they were possibly going to hang in the gallows that they were building outside?
Well, you know, if they were willing to hang and chanting that they were going to hang Mike Pence, I can't imagine he wouldn't be on the hit list as well. You know, so I think it's confusing. I think a lot of people who went to the Capitol were really deceived. I think they really are true believers who thought that the democracy had been undermined, that there was like an evil cabal of of people who were undermining the effort. They seem to have forgotten the fact that, you know, 60 courts ruled against this, you know, 90 judges and 60 courts.
Right.
I believe it was 60-1. I forget if there was the one was a motion maybe that was granted. Largely Republican courts, right, in red states who dismissed this. But we have to wrangle back from the edge. And it's almost like it's an addiction, right? An addiction to misinformation, an addiction to moral outrage. And look, we've seen a counterpart of this on the left. I think that the left has hardly, you know, covered themselves in glory in terms of dividing the voices that are the most extreme on the far left. I just think that those voices, there's a massive underweighting of how dangerous those voices are. People point to stuff in the culture, right, in academia that is preposterous. There's a lot of stories that come out that are just common sense, lowest common denominator, ridiculous of things that are said and stated. But, you know, when you get within our party, I mean, AOC endorsed how many candidates, you know, for the midterms, none of them won. She sent the Green New Deal, which was sort of a Trojan horse for more leftist policies to the Senate floor, didn't get a single vote, right? So we have very extreme, I don't want to say very extreme, I don't want to categorize her that way, but the furthest left elements of our party are not empowered, right? But they're empowered in academia, they're empowered in the mainstream media, and people somehow conflate that and don't understand that what we just saw was as if somebody from the other side, this is someone with the nuclear football, this is someone with the full power of the Senate and the judicial, right, or the DOJ behind them. And people aren't understanding how to weight these things because I think that the voices from the far left have a pretty big bullhorn in our culture, but that's not where the party is and lives. The biggest caucus in the House is the new Democrat coalition, moderate pro-capitalism. I mean, if you look at the first resolutions the House passed upon winning the midterms in 2018, what were they? It was like bipartisan for violent history checks, lowering prescription drug prices. HR1 was for anti-corruption. I mean, this is like enormously reasonable mainstream bipartisan measures that are passed. So the Democratic Party has been, the messaging of it has been so ineffective. And that's part of why I put a lot of my energy and efforts into the messaging, because the messaging is everything in some ways in the InfoWars.
So now you've got, Joe Biden, who I saw as a more centrist candidate and probably the right candidate for this moment. He's the right guy for this moment. Do you see that coming out in his policy as we go past Inauguration Day into these first 100 days?
Yeah, I think he's the only candidate who could have won. I mean, it's amazing. It was like we needed a plague. It was almost like, it's so weird. There's this weird, almost like karmic inevitability. Like Trump got elected. What did he need? He needed to run against, you know, an incredibly qualified but terrible candidate in Hillary Clinton, meaning she was brilliant and capable, but as a candidate, she was left a lot to be desired. We needed Comey, right? We needed Russia. We needed this weird event of Donald Trump. But the same thing holds true here. I mean, I think if we didn't have COVID, we'd be looking at, you know, 4 more years of Donald Trump and seeing what happened at the Capitol. I think it might have been the last free elections that we might have had.
No, I'm there with you. And I also say, had Mitch McConnell allowed a stimulus package to go through and those checks go out in October, I think he would have won then too.
It was like every single, and also had we been within 50,000 votes, I think that the mechanisms were in place for him to cheat and overpower the system through misinformation. I mean, we came unbelievably close. And so for me, the question is, how do we win people over? I mean, I spent much of the last 4 years making what I hoped were good faith arguments. Look, this to me is sort of everything right now, Rick. I've been thinking about this a lot. There's sort of two types of people who can lead in the culture and in politics. And one are the people who sort of consolidate leadership, who are impassioned, who organize and go forth and fight. And they're the leaders on that front. And there's another group, and I'm talking about journalists, politicians, people in pop culture, who reach out and extend and do sort of surveillance and interaction of the other side. They engage the other side for meaningful compromise, ideally to win people over, but at a minimum to figure out what the hell is going on over there, right? And to figure out, you know, what are the mechanisms? Can I argue with you? Can I cajole? Can we, is there a compromise to be had? In the worst case, in the best case, you want to win people over. In the worst case, you have to understand them because they're going to be the enemy. They're going to be the people who are beyond inability to compromise with. And we have spent so much time denigrating that second group. And as far as I'm concerned, for any movement, political or cultural, to be successful, we need both groups. And it seems like every time you look on Twitter or mainstream media, there's people raging. I don't want to see one more profile of understanding these people. I don't want to see one more thing about people going into a diner and talking about Trump voters. Similar stuff from the other side to us. If we don't elevate and celebrate those people to figure out a way forward with the 75 million Americans who voted for Donald Trump, who we are not just married to, we are handcuffed to them. And the 80 million people who didn't who are capable of voting, who didn't deem this election worthy of voting in, we're dead. And so we have to elevate both sides. And elevating people who are doing reconnaissance and interfacing with the opposition and the other side, you know, is not, that's not an abdication of our values. It's an elevation of understanding that in a democracy, there's all sorts of different groups. And that the only thing that gets done in America tends to be by compromise, and it tends to be a solution where not everyone gets what they want. Right. And we need that now. And Biden is somebody who exemplifies that. And I'm hoping that in the cultural and political conversation, we can start to elevate and even celebrate voices who are willing to go across and figure out what's going on and find a way forward, because we need those people piloting out who are, you know, boots on the ground out in that direction.
No, I'm right there with you. And in fact, you know, before January 6th happened, you know, one of the things that we were doing here at the program is saying, how, you know, how can we reach these people? In fact, we've partnered with a center right platform, ThinkSpot, to try and reach that audience to have these conversations. Because I've always said that I can sit down with anybody. I don't care what you believe, what your ideology is. We can sit down, have a beer, we can talk about things, and we can find common ground. I truly still believe that. But our society is telling us we can't do that.
That's right. And I will go anywhere and talk to anybody in hopes of winning them over, in hopes of talking to new audiences and making different arguments that fit with their value structure. And the thing is to do that, there's a certain amount of kind of grit and courage that's required to be a Joe Biden, to do the things that you're doing. Because what happens is you're going across the aisle, you're leaving this, the parasol, the protective parasol of your own ideology, of your in-group, right? You're leaving to go forth. Sometimes you're even taking arrows in your back to have the conversation. They're difficult conversations to have, right? And then you have to kind of have these difficult conversations, see what sort of headway can be made. You have to hold your heart open to being, I believe you can't ever convince somebody of changing their mind if you're not in a position of allowing your own mind to be changed, especially in an environment that's this polarized. It's basically like I'll show you my blind spots, you show me yours, right? It's tough. And then we kind of walk back across to our aisle and often get shouted down or yelled at for being a turncoat. And there's no way forward with that. We basically have an equal number of people on the two sides. We have an equal number of people in the middle of voting age. And we have to start to find ways to have these conversations meaningfully. And if we don't do it, we're dead, or we're just sort of in perennial warfare.
No, because, you know, one of the things that I'm hoping to hear out of Joe Biden's inauguration is this idea that we're going to make people's lives better. You know, I talk about this all the time on the program as a union guy. You know, I said it earlier. The one thing I agreed with Ronald Reagan on is that the best anti-poverty program is a job. I've amended that to the best anti-poverty program is a union job with good wages, health security, retirement security, and security on the job by having a say in your working conditions. If we can start moving in that direction to where people see a future, believe that the American dream is possible, I think a lot of these problems correct themselves. I think we're able to move in a direction that makes people's lives better, and that some of this fringe stuff people are willing to stay away from.
That's right. And if we do concrete things, like imagine if the Democrats had a single-minded purpose of addressing, for instance, the sentencing inequities between, like, the differences in sentencing guidelines between whites, I'm going to just talk about race for a moment, and black and brown accused. It's enormous. It's unfair. It's incredibly easy to talk about and frame in terms of righteousness, in terms of the law. The prison industrial complex is absurd. Anyone who watches Ava DuVernay's 13th will walk away from that and go, right, there's a whole frame on that of systemic injustice in a way that makes immediate sense under the umbrella of fundamental common sense fairness. If we could start and actually start to make headway in those ways, I think a lot of the other symbolic value struggles or symbolic battles that we have closer to the surface and the divisiveness can start to fall away. You know, likewise, for me, the biggest stat that I always return to is the fact that $50 trillion with a T in the last 40 years since Reagan have moved from the bottom 90% to the top 1%, not through free market means, right? That's through lobbyism, that's through loopholes, that's through government bailouts, that's through stock buybacks, that's through all sorts of other stuff. And some of this is due to globalization. I'm not an economist. Even economists, I feel like, don't ever have a handle on everything. But it's from not playing fair, right? And so when we talk about union jobs, when we talk about people who should just be able to work a job and fundamentally have the dignity of work, as Sherrod Brown's talks about, to make a living and support your family, it's not that we're asking for some, you know, crazy socialist readjustment of the system. What we're saying is, hey guys, let's go back and look at the TARP bailouts. Let's look at how the money, the COVID pandemic money, was handed out by Trump. Are you calling that literally free market? Like, is that money that went out on the basis of innovation and competition? Absolutely not. So we've had this incredible transfer of wealth, the opposite direction of what everyone is so afraid of in a sort of socialist frame. And part of, I think, what we're talking about is to talk about getting back to the actual fundamentals of free market capitalism, competition, innovation, right? And having workers be able to work for a functional wage. And if you can't see that, if you're rich or in the ruling class, and you can't understand that makes sense to fundamentally build a smarter capitalism all the way down the pyramid and all the way up, you've never read strategy. Like, do you want to wait 20 years and have somebody who's actually is a socialist come in and take over because the wealth divide is so great that people are only living in gated communities guarded by people with, I mean, it just doesn't make any sense.
No, and to highlight your point, I have a friend who grew up in Brazil, and he tells the story of the inequality there, where, you know, if you do fairly well, you're living behind a wall, worried about somebody snatching your kids. And this is the direction we're heading.
Does that feel like freedom? Right? No. Does that like? And the bottom line is, you know, for me, when people are doing well, where liberals tend to fail is by celebrating that, to say, good for you, right? Like, you built a business, you made a ton of money. You're worth a ton of money. Good on you. And we celebrate that. But make sure that we're keeping the system fair all the way down, so that if you're doing great this year and in 3 years, we want you doing great in 5 years, 10 years, and 20 years. The system itself has to be robust. It has to be fair so that it doesn't get overthrown. So you don't want to do a quick cash grab if we're at a point like, you know, one of the things I talked about, I went on a podcast. I went in Jordan Peterson's podcast that was just released this morning. And one of the things I was talking to him about, his audience, he's a centrist, but his audience tends center right, I would say. One of the things I was saying to him was, everyone's complaining about like socialism and how stupid people are and how dare they talk about being democratic socialists. And part of the accountability that I think is required from anybody is to say, how much has the system of capitalism failed that people are literally picking up an idea, a shiny idea, as stupid and as failed as socialism, right? And considering that as a reasonable alternative to the corruption, to the ingrained corruption they've seen through 40 years of Republican and Democratic leadership in capitalism. We can scorn them all we want, or we could look at it in terms of accountability and say, you know, how far afield have we gone from people being able to realize the American dream, that that's something they're even considering, given the track record of socialism?
Right. But here's the thing. And there's a lot of people who misdefine what socialism is, and they throw a lot of definition in with it. You believe, as I get, free market. I'm a more regulated free market guy. I'm more of the idea of going back to what we did during the FDR years. where you took off some of the razor edge of what capitalism has become. Because at the end of the day, in a truly free laissez-faire capitalist system, doesn't the guy with the most power end up winning all the time? I mean, if you go back, and the monopoly is the guy with the most money wins. And that's what we're told free market laissez-faire capitalism is. Isn't that where we end up?
Well, I agree with you. I just think that when you talk about taking the edge off, for me, I frame that as corruption and power plays. I don't frame that as an actual free market encourages innovation. It encourages competition. And that's not what we have been seeing.
Right.
From the enormous, you know, multinational corporations. We're not seeing that. And so, you know, I agree with you. I think that part of lifting that is when people can have lobbyists literally send bills to Congress without bothering to remove the letterhead from the lobbyist firm, yeah. Right? When we have, I forget the ratio. It's unbelievable, the number. It's something like 90 lobbyists. I might be wrong on this. It's an inordinately high number of lobbyists per member of Congress for big pharma. We don't get anything through. And so part of taking the edge off it with regulation is just making sure people don't cheat. So you can get up the system. It's not free market to get up to the top of the dominance hierarchy financially and then pull the ladder up after you and change the laws and change loopholes and take enormous cash bailouts, right? From TARP, from you know, the COVID pandemic relief packages in a way that has nothing to do with the free market. So I'm in agreement with you. I just think there's a way we can frame it and talk about it that appeals to a broader range of centrists and to libertarians. It's just, for me, it's a different way to frame and look at it. You've seen the math, right? CEOs in the 80s were making 300x what their workers were. Now they're making 3,000. Did they get that much smarter? Like, they're really that much brilliant in the last 20 years? Absolutely not. So some of the effects of globalism have gotten to this winner takes all game where these corporations have as much power as nation states.
And that is a huge problem. So let's bring this back to kind of wrap it up. Wednesday, Biden's going to give his speech. Does any of this come out in this? What are you expecting Joe Biden to say? And what do you want to hear?
I'd love to hear him talk about, I mean, one of the things that I think hurt us enormously when Hillary Clinton was running was she would carve up the communities, right? She would list a whole bunch of communities that she was running or appealing to. And not listed in a lot of them were sort of white working class. People forget, we have 80 to 100 million white evangelical voters in the United States of America. And I think it's important that when Biden talks about, there's a lot he owes. I don't think we win this election as liberals without the African-American community.
Correct.
Full stop, right? Stacey Abrams, Clyburn, I mean, go down the list. But I think he should be talking about communities that are suffering. I would like to see an emphasis placed on that. I would like to see an emphasis placed on getting COVID relief, getting financial relief to communities who need jobs, right? That's African-American community. I mean, I'm sure this has been even worse at a time. 1 out of every 1,000 African-Americans had already died of COVID. I'm sure that number is worse now, right? But we have white working class communities who have been just ravished by the opioid epidemic, right? And if you lay a map over them, right, that's a lot of the Trump voters. He's got to reach out to communities that are suffering. And I think that I want to see that to be a sort of an outreach. And the other thing is we have to have him figure out how to actually pass governance. We have to pass bills. We have to govern. And that involves compromise. It involves unity, and it involves working with the other side. And I think that after the sort of abuse and corruption of the Trump era, people are sitting back and just thinking that we can go, certain people are hoping there's an administration that can go sort of scorched earth. It's not going to work. It's not how legislation and governance works. It's not how votes work in the House or the Senate. It's not how Democrats win and hold seats in purple districts. Democrats like Lucy McBath in Georgia, Democrats like Alyssa Slotkin in Michigan and Haley Stevens. And our passions are not the only passions that there are. And we have to remember that there's a giant range of people who are suffering, who are passionate, who are different communities who need different things. And we have to widen our lens beyond the sort of funnel that we've gotten of information that has narrowed us to believe that our passions are the only ones.
We will see what comes out of it. I'm looking forward to it. I'm, you know, after this darkness, it's kind of like going to the light. I have great hopes for this president. I have great hopes for him to do the things that we need in the moment that we need them, and to put people, the smart people, into the right places, so that we don't have the failures that we've had. But we'll see. And Greg, it'd be great to have you back and share some thoughts on the other side. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, it's always good talking to you, Rick.
Good stuff. Our good friend Greg Hurwitz, New York Times bestseller. Check out his website, greghurwitz.net. We'll get links out on social media how you can check that out. Gonna take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.